Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, and this is Hillary Burns, and today we have a special guest. Man, I'm already crying. We have Ed Hageum, and I am just going to read something. I'm not going to tell you his whole bio. That would impress you, but this is one of his books is called, wait, I got stickies all over it. Hold on, because I have so much to talk to him about. It's called On the Road Less Traveled, an unlikely journey from the orphanage to the boardroom. At the age of 3, Ed Hageum is kidnapped by his father, driven cross-country, and told his mother is dead. He presses his face against the car window, watches the miles pass, and wonders where life will take him, where you'd least expect. And now we have the boy himself, Ed Hageum.
Not the boy anymore, but all right, thank you.
And also, so Ed has 2 books that I've been reading simultaneously, and this is his other book, The Island of the 4 Ps, A Modern Fable About Preparing for Your Future. So I got to read them both at the same time, which was very, very interesting because one ties into the other. But anyway, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. All right. So when I hear orphan, I hear a boy with no parents. And yet you had them. You kind of had them, but you were still an orphan, right?
That's right.
Now, okay, I have so many questions. They're all like, woo. So how did your father, your father was a successful businessman in New York. The stock market crashed. He lost everything. He goes across country. How did he end up at your mother's house?
It was a distant cousin house. It was in St. Louis. It was halfway across country. He stopped there, and he wasn't welcomed because, you know, in those days, nobody was welcomed. 1933, nobody needed to know the mouth to feed. But shockingly, he fell in love with the 18-year-old, the fourth among 5 siblings in the household. And she wanted to get away from the household because, you know, it wasn't terribly comfortable. And he was a good-looking but 15 years older person with a car, and he was on his way to California, where the streets were paved with gold. So they got married. And on the way to California, of course, when they arrived, 1933, in California, streets weren't paved with gold. And as you can see, Dad had trouble getting a job. He had demons from losing all his money. He also was a Middle Eastern background, so he treated women not with the greatest of respect. And, 3 years later, I was born, supposedly the only happy day in their lives. On my birth certificate, it was to an unemployed father and a homemaker mother. He wouldn't let her work. And, the rest is in the book, but what happened 3 years later, she just couldn't put up with the peripatetic experience he had. He went all over the country trying to find a job. When he get a job, he couldn't keep it very long because he was very difficult to deal with. Very smart man, but difficult to deal with. So she finally divorced him in 1939.
And I have a question. Why, if he was so successful on Wall Street, why couldn't he go back and do that again?
He wasn't on Wall Street. As a teenager and then into his early 20s, he became very excited about the technology of the day, which was radio. Okay. And I believe he worked for RCA. And as you know, RCA's stock in the 20s went up 10 times. And in those days, you could leverage that 10 to 1. and he made most of his money in the stock market, you know. And when the stock market crashed, he was on margin and had borrowed a lot of money to buy real estate and so forth. So everything went. I mean, as he said, he tells me that 1933, he said, I had a car and a box of cigars, either of which I really owned. He said, I had a decision between committing suicide and driving to California. Of course, I'm very lucky they decided on the second thing rather than the first. I wouldn't be.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, they got divorced, and she got custody, and she took me from Los Angeles to St. Louis to live with her parents. She was not welcome. Again, nobody was welcome in those days, and an extra couple miles to feed. And he got visiting rights on Sundays only and $5 a week in child support and alimony. And he waited a month or so, I guess, and came for a Sunday. And instead of taking me to the park or to the movies, he got back on the Highway 66, and we ended up in California. And he basically told me subsequently that she had passed away and I would never see her. And he called her and told her never to look for us. And that's the cover of the book. That's he and I driving to California.
Right. Now, and you were only three, so of course.
I was only three, so I probably didn't understand what he was talking about. But, you know, he did tell me she died and that I was never going to see her.
Now, do you...
He was a radio operator aboard a ship. He found a profession. And that basically made me an orphan, because even the 2 years we spent together, those first 2 years, he was away on a ship and I was with neighbors. I had no family, neighbors, or friends' homes. And I have letters from that effect. Mrs. Bennett, you know, she was a friend of his, so she kept me while he was at sea. And so then in 1941, when the war broke out, he was either drafted or volunteered to become an officer in the Merchant Marines, and therefore I had to be put into foster homes. And that was the beginning of a 15-year period when I was really basically an orphan, except for 1 year, when he and I reconnected back after the war was over. We spent a year together, first in the YMCA on 34th Street for the summer, and then in a hotel room in Coney Island for that year while he looked for land-based work. When he couldn't find land-based work, he had basically go back to sea. And actually, part of the summer of 1947, I actually spent that alone, because he got pulled away and the person who was going to take me wouldn't take me. So I spent the time in that hotel room in Coney Island for, I don't know, period of time by myself. And then when
How old were you? 10?
11. I was 11. I would get up in the morning and get on the subway for a nickel and go to the museums and go to the giant polo grounds, watch the Giants play, and come back in time, hopefully before dark.
Were you scared?
Cool. I guess so. Yes, I guess so. Because I always tried to get home before dark, because Coney Island was not a good place in those days.
He left you money?
He left me money, and he also left money with the delicatessen to make sure I get my meals there, and told the manager of the hotel to keep track of me. But come September, the woman who was going to take me decided against it, and he was able to get me into an orphanage in Far Rockaway. So I went foster homes in California, orphanages in Far Rockaway, and then when I aged out of that orphanage in Far Rockaway, he disappeared completely. That was what I call the fourth abandonment. He abandoned me when he was three, when I got divorced. He abandoned me when he was five, when he had to go to sea. And he abandoned me again at 11, when he had to go to sea again. And then at 15, he disappeared completely. And one of the problems with my original ghostwriter, they wanted me to hate my father. And I love my father, because he's all I had. And now I'm glad I wrote those books, because I understand what he went through. He was born at the wrong time and had a lot of bad breaks. But anyway, he disappeared when I was 15, aged out of the orphanage, became a ward of the state. And luckily, some wonderful social worker, instead of sending me to a reform school, because you could send, those days are not nice places to go when you were 15 and without a ward of the state. I was put in another orphanage in Yonkers, New York, which was about five blocks from a fabulous, public high school, Roosevelt High School, which 80% of the kids went to something called a private college. And of course, I got an epiphany then, said, this is my ticket out of my circumstance. And that's what changed everything. And put my head down, became a good student and a varsity athlete. But there weren't many scholarships in those days. There were about three or four real scholarships. And I didn't get the ones I thought I would get. And I ended up getting the NRTC scholarship, which was a real break, which allowed me to go to University of Rochester. I wanted to go to Cornell or Rensselaer, but when I got the NRTC scholarship, because of the naval science courses, Those schools were 5 years. Rochester, for whatever reason, said they'd get me through in four. I didn't know anything about Rochester at all. I put it down on my, I mean, you weren't allowed to apply to three colleges in those days.
Wow.
So the principal was a graduate of the University of Rochester or knew the Rochester people. So he said, put Rochester down. And Rochester said they'd get me through in 4 years. Of course, that required me to go to class, 8 o'clock class every day for 5 days. And I had a laboratory every afternoon for 4 years, and I had to take a summer course to get through. So they told a little fib when they said they'd get me through in 4 years, but I got through in 4 years. And it was a great experience. Rochester turned out to be my first home, and it was pretty special.
All right.
Long answer, short question. Sorry.
Question. No, that's fine. That's fine. Didn't your father have family in New York?
No, not that I knew of. He may have had family. There's, you know, when I go back and dig in places, it looks like my mother died. His mother died in the 30s, right? That's when he lost all his money. He lost his mother too. And 2 years later, he lost his father.
Okay.
He supposedly had a brother, which I've never really researched because he said he was an only child. But there was some letters that appeared there was another sibling. But that was it. And everybody else he kept me away from. All through his life, he said, I want you to be an American. And whenever he'd have friends over or, you know, distant relatives, they speak in, you know, either some, you know, foreign languages. He would take me out of the room because he wanted me to be an American. American, you know. So, but I didn't meet any of the relatives. I never met a relative.
Wow. Now, did you ever think, and I know you can't go back, but in all those years of leaving you, that he could have said, let's take you to your mother's.
Yeah, could have.
At least you'd have cousins and stuff like that.
He was very negative. He basically said my mother did not like children. So he said that she died in childbirth, which was totally incorrect. But
right.
I didn't know any different. And of course, as time went on, I actually, when I was got to be in my 10, my early teens, I started to bludgeon him with questions about my mother, and he always shut me down. She's a bad woman. She's gone, you know, and he never really told me. So, and he died suddenly, so he never got a chance to really tell.
Yeah. Isn't that, you know, you wonder. I mean, keeping a secret like that, right? Or do you think he was just so, I don't know, it didn't bother him?
My mother, he could have. My mother married again. You know, and had another son. That's one of the funny stories is when I met her, he said, she called up her son and said, remember that brother you always wanted?
Here he is.
Here he is. Yeah. A little older than you, but
yeah,
not much, actually. 12 years older, but yeah, she married another man. Life has been very lucky because her husband died, I don't know, 3 years before I found her, which was really interesting. So it sort of worked out. We can get into that if you'd like, but. Now, he could have put me by my mother, but he basically didn't like her. I mean, it was not a good situation. Of course, she divorced him, and that was embarrassing and difficult and so on. So.
Wow. So it was easier for him to say she died, and then shame, right?
It's easy for me, too. It was a simple thing. Rather than talk about the difficulties, I people ask me, well, my father's a merchant marine. He's always at sea. My mother died when I was three. It rhymes.
There you go. Okay. Wow. All right. Now, what you said, because there's a lot of people who could have gone down the tubes, given that, especially being left in a hotel by yourself at age 11. I mean, that's like, I can't imagine. I just can't, you know, and seeing kids, my kids are in their 20s. I can't imagine, you know what I mean? Like, so, you know, obviously it taught you, it gave you so much strength. It gave you so much independence, you know, that carried on in your life to have you become so successful. But what would you say, you know, if there's children out there who are struggling or they think their situation is, you know, poor me or whatever, what would you say to them resolve?
The reason I was able to sustain myself when I was 11 is because between 6 and 10, I was in 5 different foster homes. And 5 different Catholic schools and 5 different Catholic school yards. So I developed what one would call resilience. Resilience is like a muscle, you know, Once you're able, and also I developed adaptability. So this is what I tell young people. I said, all the things you're going through, and there's a lot of group first gens that I talk to, these things that you're going through are actually disadvantages now, but become advantages later on. Your disadvantages become advantages. Going through five schoolyards, I became pretty adaptable. By the third schoolyard, I knew exactly how to position myself so I wouldn't get pushed around. And the same thing with schools. I had to adjust to the different schools. So I become adaptable. I become resilient. And once you're sort of successful in that after a period of time, and children are successful, they will get through it, like the young children. So you get a little person on your shoulder that says, you know, you can do it. It's a confidence builder. You get self-confidence out of that. I also think, you know, that was the Catholic school is one. My father also, give him credit. He always said that I was going to be great someday. He gave me positive reinforcement. And, you know, the two things I ask people, forget about money or anything else, unconditional love and positive reinforcement for children, even if they're poor like I was, you know, or you read about that. One of the foster parents said he came with a bag full of rags, you know, to the new home.
Yeah.
But I got unconditional love, and he wrote these letters. I mean, in fact, I wrote a letter back saying, Dad, I'm not as good as you think I am. And I said, I said, you know, I am a bad boy occasionally. I mean, these letters, interesting. I kept all my letters. He kept every of my letters. Then the third thing, which I, you know, I'm digging around, writing books and listening, because I answered that question has been asked me a number of times. We went to the movies every Saturday. And on Saturday, there were heroes.
Hmm.
There was John Wayne. I mean, and they always did the right thing. So you had role models, you know. You get parents as role models, but these people. So I think my father, the Catholic Church, the Catholic schools, and these role models that were set up. There's also something in me which I still haven't figured out, that I was going to make it. I was going to somehow. Fact is, today I'm still too serious, even at this age. My wife says, you know, why don't we sit on the porch more?
Yeah. Sure.
I'm on this crusade now. We'll come to it later. You know, trying to change, this is a joke, it's presumptuous on my part, to college education. I mean, what do you want to do that for? You know, that's hard work. But yeah, it's just that there's something in there. Maybe it's a combination of genes or something, or right situation. But there's that fourth thing that I haven't got my hands around yet that has driven me most of my life to, you know, to do better.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Another question. You had a couple of good families out in California, and then your father, you know, obviously you were going to go meet him. He was the guy, and then he takes off again. I know there probably wasn't, or you would have, but like, I kept thinking as I'm reading, can't you go back to that nice family in California who they were treating you like their son and stuff?
They were fabulous. She was convinced that I was going to be a musician. I mean, I was only there 6 months. I think I went through three or four instruments, you know. She tried to do the saxophone and piano. And she, you know, she was a wonderful lady, and she treated me very much like her son. She couldn't have any more children, and she wanted another child, and they liked me. And then I can still remember them. It was a wonderful experience. And unfortunately, it got interrupted because my father wanted me back again, and so I traveled across country. But that would have been a wonderful family. They lived right on the Redondo Beach, and you crossed over the street and down into the cliff, down into the water. It was a beautiful old house. I can still remember it. And he was a nice fellow, their son. So got along extremely well. Some of the kids, places where I lived were not, you know, the first forest storm was awful. I mean, it was cold and abusive, and, you know, the kids were not very friendly. And, you know, so, but the last Mrs. Robb, the last woman, was just fabulous. And I could have gone. If I'd have gone back there, I'd probably have been a different person, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, but at least she was not. I mean, at least you had a good experience.
Well, no, again, you say what drove me? That was another role model. You know, I didn't think of it at that time, but that was I wanted to have a family that was loving. And, you know, there was. I had an example. I had the other example as well. So that's essentially, and again, in the Catholic Church, they made it very clear, you know, they taught you the golden rule. They made it very clear, if you do the right things, you end up in this nice place. And if you do the wrong things, you end up in the other place. That kind of sticks in the head of a seven-year-old.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. Okay. Yeah, I was always wondering, like, why can't he just go back? Don't leave him in the hotel. in the back, you know? I was like, come on, talking through the pages.
It wasn't really his fault. We were all set ready. This woman was going to take me. I was supposed to transfer to her home, and she changed her mind the week before, and he had to go. He was signed on to go on board a ship, and so there's nothing he could do.
But how could she change her mind? I mean, that's, like, rude. And there you are. Like, how could you do that to a little boy? But obviously she did, and it's a story. But I was like, you know, crazy. So anyway, and you ended up in, was it the Jewish home now?
No, it was the Israel Orphan Asylum. Israel, IOA, Israel Orphan Asylum in Far Rockaway, 2540 Beach Canal Drive. How can I remember that? Just
wow.
Like yesterday. And I arrived there, and they said, here's Eddie. He reads. And of course, I didn't read. I was a little dyslexic and so forth, but that was the story. And it was, I changed my single room in the hotel for a room with 50 guys in it, 50 kids in it.
Yeah.
And that was quite a, and all my closet space went into a drawer under my bed. But, you know, it was the orphan asylum gave me the two things I never had for the first, you know, 11 years of my life, which is I had consistency and community. And it also, with those days, the local public school was just unbelievable. It was really a wonderful public school. And I flourished at that school. I mean, that's in the book as well. I did all the things. I was a 4'6" basketball player, ping pong champion, and all that kind of stuff. But it was a good experience. And I flourished there. But the things that happened in an orphanage, you don't get some of the things that kids get. I never learned to ride a bicycle. I never learned to swim. These are, you know, the pool was only 3 feet deep. There were too many kids in it at all times. So, but, you know.
I've heard a couple of stories where the people ended up in those, well, they called them, I don't know if they called them the Jewish homes, but the Jewish Academy, they called it. And they, you know, it really seemed like such a wonderful place that they were funded, that kids had a place to be, you know, because a lot of the parents couldn't. I don't know, one woman, the husband left and the mother was pregnant. And anyway,
most of the people of the Israel Orphan Asylum weren't orphans. Most of the kids had one parent.
But
they had one parent who couldn't afford to keep them or something like that. Yeah, but most kids had one parent.
But it was really...
But Dad quickly
blessing, became right?
Persona non grata because he argued about how much he was paying, and then I had to travel to see him. He never came to see me, so one of those things.
Wow. All right. So anyway, you made it through, and if you want more of the details, I'm just gonna say, get this book. It's an incredible. I could not put it down. It's an incredible story. You go. I'll just fill them in. Go to college. Go to end up. Getting amazing jobs, go to Harvard Business School, and you end up on Wall Street, right?
Right.
I mean, a roundabout way. A lot of stops. And
don't forget my time as a chemical engineer when I was in plastics before Dustin Hoffman.
Right. Plastic, yeah. So it's quite, you know, the path, but you seem to always know when it was time to leave, right? So this is the part I didn't tell you before. When you were down at E.F. Hutton, it was the early 80s. I was a consultant. I worked for Arthur Young, one of the big eight accounting firms at that time. And one of my, I started it down in Washington, D.C. We were doing a lot of government stuff. And then I transferred to New York. And let's see, we did a project for the Long Island Railroad. But then I ended up going down to E.F. Hutton. So I was there in the operations.
Oh, wow.
And I befriended, well, she took me under her wing, thank God, because I didn't know anything. Down in operations, we did a study. I don't even remember what it was. But so I was like, whoa, I was there. And then, then we went to Citibank. And then I got recruited by Drexel Burnham.
Whoa.
So
we could have crossed paths. We could have easily crossed paths.
Yeah.
A lot of Drexel Burnhams were my friends, quite a few of them.
And when you said Fred Joseph came to...
Fred Joseph came to Furman Sells when I was the chairman.
Yeah, I was like, oh my God. So when they went bankrupt, I was only there from 86 to 1990. I got hired the week that Ivan Boesky got arrested. So I was on the downturn, you know? And then But it was a great place. I mean, it was like high school.
Well, Wall Street was a movie. I mean, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. You know, it was a great experience.
Yeah.
And I came at the right time and left at the right time.
Yeah. So my question, because I don't know that I could have left. Like, you, when you saw, you know, because E.F. Hutton went down, right? Or they got bought, and then you were with Lehman, and then they went, I mean, how did you have the courage or the fortitude to leave before they went down? Like, you jumped off, I know you kept talking about your instincts, like you could feel it. And that's a gift, because I don't think most people have that. But how did you know? Anyway, I'll be quiet and let you answer.
If you read the last line in my book, On the Road Less Traveled, my wife asks the question, you know, what's going to happen? And my magic two words, besides thank you, is what's next? Mm-hmm. I always focus on what's next. And in Hutton, you know, I was having a great time. I mean, I've done a great job in institutional business. Bob Fullman and I were very close personal friends. We drove back and forth together. I said, Bob, the business is going to change from retail to institutional. And, you know, he said, no, we're staying in retail. I said, Bob, you got to go. He wouldn't do it. So Lehman was then really moved aggressively in institutional, and they recruited me. I mean, I didn't go after the job. They took 6 months to recruit, and they gave me a job I couldn't turn down. I was one of the youngest members in the 150-year history on the board. I was the president of Lehman Securities. I got the whole securities business, and so on and so on and so on. So I went to Lehman. Lehman, though, this was a stroke of fate. I didn't get along with this guy Glucksman, who ran the firm. Horrible person. And even in the book Greed and Glory on Wall Street, it said Glucksman hated Hageum. But anyway, I spent 7 years there, 3 years running the securities business. Then they pushed me out of that into the backwater, which was money management. I raised $7.5 billion in 2.5 years. And if I pushed me out of that, and then I got my dream job. And then what was next for me was to, now that I'd made enough money, I didn't make enough to, you know, forever, but I made enough money, I could really go back to, you know, my passion, which was to run a firm. Mm-hmm. And Furman Sells popped up. It was a little firm. I'd known the two, Furman and Sells. It was a tiny little firm, $20 million in revenues. I was running a division of Lehman that had about $200 million in revenues. And we had 200 people. And Furman Sells only had 70 people. And I always say I traded my office, which overlooked the entire harbor, for an office that overlooked a brick wall. And I traded the best dining room on Wall Street for a conference room with two hot plates in it.
Wow.
But I got my dream job. Yeah. And with the four Ps, I can now exercise my passion. I could put my principles into operation. I could find my right partners, and I could write my plans. So I went to Furman Sells from Lehman Brothers. And in case of Furman Sells.
Question. How were you so good at what you did that everywhere you went, you just grew it? I mean, it seemed like it was effortless for you. Obviously, I wasn't there, and, you know, but what about you had you be, not everyone could do that, you know. What had you be able to do that?
Let me snap back. It's a great question. Snap back to my junior year at college when I decided to do something really not very intelligent, which was to form a humor magazine. I felt that Rochester Street was a place where fun went to die, and everybody was against it. The provost was against it. The prison was against it. The librarian was against it. But I put 30 people together, and I said, we're going to do a humor magazine like Lampoon at Harvard. And we did it. And what I found is that's what was my passion, was to put people together to solve problems, to create a product program. But inside that, the secret, which I didn't recognize until, you know, like the question you just asked, is I got a kick out of and really got excited about helping people do better than they thought they could. Mm. When people came in contact with me, in many cases, not all cases, obviously, they felt that I really wanted them to do better. And that was my secret to management. And that's why I think I did better on almost every job that I've taken, and in the university as well, when I became the chairman of the board of trustees. Almost everything I do, even today, I have people calling me and saying, you know, what do you think, Ed? You know, because they know that I'm interested in them. Mm. I have a young lady that was a valet at my golf club, and she's just called me from University of Utah, and she's having trouble studying, and she knows that I want her to do better. So it's you know, and then my principle there was, you know, I have it on my wall right now. It says, there's nothing more. It says there's no limit to what a person can do and where he can go if he doesn't mind who gets the credit. And that, you know, you build your passion and you find some principles that help you exercise that passion. But I love putting people together. And also, I recognize
you didn't do it for you. You know what I mean? Like, you weren't doing it for any other reason than, like, you really wanted them to be better than they could, right? Like, that was an internal thing.
And it was something, it was a vibe that I sent out. It was a vibe that I sent out. Yeah, really interested in you doing better, right?
But it wasn't so that you could succeed.
To actually succeed, yeah. Right, exactly.
It wasn't, right?
No, I didn't. I was always felt that I would succeed if I did this. And I went at each problem to solve the problem or to you know. And again, What's Next helped me quite a bit. Because when I was at Furman Sales, we were a little tiny firm. Every year I said to the guys, What's next? What are we going to do now? Oh, it's because we'll be out of business otherwise. Mm. And we grew it from $20 million to almost $500 million, $480 million revenues. Sold it to Xerox, bought it back, and then sold it to Dutch company. It was a, you know, God bless, you know.
But, well, now I forget what I was going to ask you.
I'm sorry.
But, oof. So do you think you were so good because you would bring in good? I mean, you couldn't have known how to do all of this stuff. At each place, you were doing something different. You knew who to bring in and you knew how to get, you knew, what did you say? You knew how to help people do better than they thought they could. So if the people you bring are doing better, then everyone succeeds.
But you also just elucidated the third partner. The third P is partners.
Okay.
I found that I was only good as the people I surround myself with. That's another very big secret. You know, today, especially in today's world, you can't do anything without help. And so therefore, you know, finding the kind of partners you need and the kind of partners you want is very important. And I found in business three partners. One, people that could do partners that I could do things I couldn't do.
Period.
You know, partners that could do things better than I could do them. The third partner nobody realizes, I wanted to find partners who do things that I do really well that I don't want to do. Mm-hmm. If I could find that partner, I did, you know, I ended up doing things that I want to do that I did well. So that was my secret. Mm. And wow. Each organization, you need different kinds of partners. When you work in the Edie Masonary area, you know, like a university, you need different kind of partners. And I found a partner, and actually somebody found him for me, 6'5" Dartmouth young man. When
the
I was
accounting guy, the finance guy,
Yeah. He did all the accounting, which I struggled with. I mean, I took accounting and accounting.
Yeah,
he did IT. He did HR. You know, all that stuff.
You got to read the book to find out about this guy. No, I mean, that was incredible, right? You almost didn't take him. But all right, we got to take our commercial break and then we'll come back. Okay. This hour is going to pass too fast. But all right, we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of three books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Okay, welcome back. And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, Kokori. Kokori is a social-emotional learning platform that brings, I would say, everything that ED stands for to our children. It helps them get connected, helps them belong, helps them behave better, helps them learn better, because all their activities are based around play. So they play, they connect, they reflect, and they grow. Please, if you have contacts in schools, tell them about Kokori. They can find that at kokoriapp.com, KIKORIAPP.com. I believe them. I believe in them wholeheartedly. Okay. And then my books, let's see, which do I start with? Okay. I'll start with this one. Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. These are techniques that I got. I didn't really have anything bad happen, but in my mind I did. I was kind of a victim. So these are tools and techniques to get me from the victim side of life over to the fun side of life. And I put them all together in a book in case there was anyone negative like me who might need some help. So Your Bullshit is Your Blessing, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun. Okay. This one, I'm going backwards, was my second book, Real Talk, How to Say the Things You've Never Said so you can have the things you've always wanted as a people pleaser. I had a hard time speaking up. And so once I did, I realized, wow, life is getting pretty good. So I wanted to make that available in case anyone else had that as a hard thing like I did. And then my very first book, this is my memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast. If Marriage Was My Dream, Why Was I Numbing Myself? And this is a story that I wrote because I was stuck kind of in a dark place. I got out of it. I created a life I love. And I thought, you know what? Just in case anybody else is stuck there, let them read the book and get inspired. You can find all of them on Amazon. And now we're going to bring back Ed Hajum. I learned how to say his name. Yay. Okay. So, all right. Let's just show them your books again. We have The Island of the Four Peas, a modern fable about preparing for your future. Really unbelievable. And the story's great. And also, we haven't said that the pictures, I don't know who did these pictures. Well, but they're beautiful. I mean, the whole book, you know, you have this beautiful cover. The whole book is just, it's beautiful. The story's great. The illustrations are great. It just makes.
And the woman who did the audible, by the way, had six voices. First time she's ever done that. And you can listen to it in 2.5 hours.
Wow. Okay. I definitely recommend it. Put it on in the car. You got to do the exercises. That's the thing. I'm still stuck on one of them. But anyway, it really can change your life. And then again, on the road, less traveled. This one, you will not be able to put down. You'll just be caught up in Ed's life. I feel like I lived his life for the last couple of weeks. I would wake up thinking about it. I would wake up with questions. I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. Yeah. So really, I mean, and that's, to me, that's a sign of a good book, is when you're in the book, you're living the book. And I feel like I just lived your life. I was like, now I want to talk to his wife, Barbara, right? I'm like, I have questions for her too, right? All right. Let me ask you the one question about Barbara. And I don't know if you can answer it. So they've been married how many years?
60 next August.
Okay, 60 years. When she met you, when she was young and you were a little bit older, but she decided she was going to marry you, right? I'm sure you were cute, but what else was it that had her go cross country and chase you until she got you? Do you know?
She says it was physical.
Oh, wow.
That we were just, you know, she was 14 and, you know, and I was 20 and I went to her house because I was transferring Humor Magazine's editorship from myself to her brother, and who was a class behind me at Rochester. And we were there for 3 days. She was buzzing around, and I kept brushing her off. She was getting in our way. And when I left, she told her mother she was going to marry me. And I didn't think anything of it. Of course, I didn't know about it. But when I was at Harvard, I got a call from him saying, would I be best man at his wedding? And I said, sure. And then I realized I didn't have any money. So I ran over to the place more often and said, find me a ticket. I don't care what it is. And they said, we got this mutual fund company. And okay, but I'll do it. And her mother called me and said, would I take little Barbara to the wedding on the plane? And I think they were in cahoots, I think. Anyway, little Barbara showed up at Idlewild Airport, Kennedy now. And I had to pass the word for her because she passed me a couple of times. I didn't recognize her. Anyway, we went out together, put her head on my shoulder in the airplane. We danced at the wedding. Everything was fine. I went and got the interview with this company, which I really wasn't interested in. And it turns out we went back to the East. I had called her up and said, would you come up for a weekend? She said, sure. I said, okay, I'll fix you up with someone your own age. I did. And then I dated her once more. I couldn't get a date, so I called and she actually spent a weekend with me. And then she was working in Connecticut as a teacher. I was going to take a job on Wall Street, and I changed my mind last minute and went to work for that company that I didn't want to go to work for in California for 10 years.
Wow.
And then she followed me out and applied to the University of California, San Francisco, to a master's degree in counseling. And we dated that whole year, and it was over. I ran after her until she caught me.
Right. So it was physical, huh?
And I love her more than yesterday.
Yeah.
More than yesterday and less than tomorrow.
Wow. Well, good for her, you know? I give her a lot of credit. I really do. So.
No, but there was an attraction. Yeah. And as soon as I got to spend a lot of time with her, it was automatic, you know?
Right. And then as you get older, the age isn't such a big deal, right?
No, it's not. No.
I mean, when you're 11 and 18, that's kind of a big difference, but I don't know.
Yeah, it was a big difference.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's such a happy story. And I know you finally got the family.
I started with one and we're 16 now. So, you know, that's pretty good.
What do you mean 16?
Well, there are eight. We have there's six of us, the married couples eight grandchildren.
Oh.
And I don't get away with it. My oldest son got divorced, which, you know, nobody gets away with it. After 23 years, he decided he was going to do his own thing. He has three boys, and that was kind of sad.
So is he the Hawaii one?
The Hawaii one, yeah.
Yeah.
He's now in the Philippines scuba diving. You know, he's a scuba diver and underwater photographer and a movie maker. You know, he was a very creative guy, but he just didn't want to be married anymore. Huh. And all his kids are away. They're all either in college or working. So.
Wow. All right. So let's go because we have 13 minutes left. Let's talk about your course because that's really what you want to spread the word on, right?
Right.
Why don't you tell us now? Was it based on this book?
Based on the Island of Four Peas.
Okay. So tell
based
us
on the concept.
Yeah.
Based on the concept, as I said, that there's two kinds of education. One teaches you how to make a living. Another teaches you how to make a life. And I think schools do a good job or a decent job of teaching. In fact, I'm on a crusade with that, having more people go to, you know, learn trades. I've got some program on that. I can discuss that. But in case I want people to teach people, they teach people how to make a living, but they don't teach them how to make a life. So what I want to do basically is have either seniors in high school or freshmen in college spend time thinking about who they are. Hmm. Who am I? Where do I want to go? How do I expect to get there? And why do I want to go to that particular place? And I want to write it down. So I've given them what I consider the four important words in life. One is self, family, work, and community. Community is my work, giving back. Those are the four parts of life. Into those four parts of life, I want to pump in the four P's. Find your passions, find your principles, find your partners, and find your plans. And what I'm trying to create is a simple vocabulary for each young person's inner voice. They can add to it. This is not something that's, you know, set in stone. They can fix it their own way. But I want them to, on a regular basis, go through these four parts of life. And by the way, you said something is bullshit. Balance is bullshit. There's harmony between those four parts of life at best. Because by definition, if you focus on one of them, you neglect the other one.
Right.
And early on, you focus on yourself. You don't think much about family or work or business. Then you start to work on family and business. Later on in life, like I am, I'm focused much more on community. And The four P's basically are you keep going over those passions, overused word, talents, interests, likes and dislikes, and also context. If you're in Kiev, you have different passions than you do in New York City. Principles the same way. You add principles all your life. I talked about the most important principle from the Catholic Church, do unto others. Then, you know, all through your life, you build principles. I always tell about the fact that this idea of not worrying about who gets the credit. Well, the first thing I did, I added a principle to that. Start deflecting credit. You find when you deflect credit, all kinds of good things happen. Partners, I discuss partners. Most important partner, of course, is P1. If you can find P1, you know, like I did in Barbara, you know, someone to share your life with, someone you can support, who can support you. So what I've done is I developed a template, an 8-session template, which I now have distributed to 5 different schools, all of which are now putting them into practice. One school is at 115 students with 4 different sections. Each of these, the template is a skeleton. Each school's got to develop its own process, its own, what's unique, it has a unique population. You know, I'm working in Greenwich, Connecticut and Newark. Newark is first gens, Greenwich, Connecticut are fairly well-to-do kids. Different requirements. Same thing, difference between Rochester and Hobart or Sacred Heart. Each one will hang on to that template. And I'm actually building a syllabus, which is going to add a little more to the template. But I really think the template's almost enough.
Do you teach these yourself?
The reason I've only done a few at a time is I usually have to start them. The one at Rochester, which has 115 students, they've separated it into, you know, areas like engineering, healthcare, arts and sciences. So they have the same kind of kids in them. I usually start the first session and then the last session, or I go up there. There's a YouTube of me at Hobart. There's an hour YouTube, which has been looked at by quite a few people, that I discuss it with the president of the university and with a young fellow who's the president of his fraternity. They interviewed me for an hour, and it was quite an experience. And it was kind of interesting. But see, what I really want is them to think, in other words, if you graduate with a diploma and a life design, I think you're way ahead. Mm-hmm. Think about all the things you learned at college, which are not terribly important anymore. I was a slide rule guru. I know people don't even, in fact, I mentioned slide rule at Hobart. Half the kids didn't know what that was. But then I got out of the Navy, there was something called a computer. Mm. You know, slide rule was thrown away. A lot of the things I learned in chemical engineering became worthless within 3 to 4 years. And so, but a life design will last a lifetime. And I use it also for people in transition. If you're 50 years old and you've been working for a company for 20 years and you want to get change, go through this process of thinking about the 4 parts of life. Think about your passions. You know, and what's nice about Rochester is they force the freshmen into 3 life scenarios. Force them. You know, one that you think you'll make a living in, one, you know, that your parents want you to go into, one that you really like to go into, you know. And so you may go back to that third thing. And I look at my life. I really wanted to run a company. I started too early trying that, and I failed. I went back in, delayed gratification, got enough capabilities, then finally found a place where I could exercise my passion and, you know, do what I really wanted to do. So this course in my mind, and this is presumptuous on my part, I think we can add a dimension to college education where they come out with this life design, something they carry with them the rest of their life, and they keep adding to it, subtracting from it. I'm interested in principles. One of my principles on Wall Street, you'll go back and find this out, was to live happy, was to live hidden. Stay out of the press. Yeah. Don't do any comments. People didn't know who I was. I was the CEO and chairman, but they didn't know who I was, which was good because I was focused on running the business. Because I didn't have the, can people have the capability of doing both? I couldn't do both, and I knew that. Now that I'm, you know, selling ideas and books and so forth, I've abandoned the living happy is live hidden. I'm out talking to the Hillarys of the world and scaring myself to death that I'm in public eye.
Wow.
Because, you know, you get in trouble when you do that. That's a quick and dirty experience of it. I have a brochure which I send out to schools, and I'm ready to sort of really go public with it because I think there seems to be an unsatisfied need. But until you focus on the fact that you have no control over who you are and recognize that, then you really can't go after that. So those are the kinds of the things I want young people to recognize. And if you have a lot of bad habits and it's not your fault, you can spend time getting rid of them. I use my own example. although the wonderful disadvantages I had became advantages, one huge disadvantage that was not an advantage is I was angry. Mm. I suffered from, why me? I've answered the question too long again, love. Sorry.
No. I love it. I was going to ask you about that. I don't blame you for being angry. And your father was angry. I think there's a lot of angry people. And I think, why me is a great question.
Why am I in an orphanage?
Why you?
Well, I have a home. Don't I have a bicycle?
Rolling
on your head,
So how did you resolve that?
Well, I threw tennis rackets for, golf clubs for a while. And slowly but surely, I realized it wasn't an attractive thing to do and kind of worked on it. I didn't get help until my father died. Because getting help in my day was a bad idea. If you got help, you were not good. They didn't have counselors for mental health. When my father died, though, I got some help from the Ackerman Institute in New York. I had a wonderful woman that I worked with for about a year, and I worked on that. And also, this is a great experience. My father died suddenly of a heart attack, and we had a lot of unanswered questions. She had me write letters to him and then have me write letters back to me pretending I was him. Did that for about 6 months. And she was a wonderful lady. And William Penn was her. She was Peggy Penn. William Penn was her husband. And so that was a great experience. But I've also I still work on it. I get angry. It's interesting. You never get away from it. On Sunday afternoons, when everybody came visiting hours at the orphanage, I rarely got visited. On Sunday afternoon, if I'm not careful, I start to go down a little.
Oh, wow.
It's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
But what happens with writing a book and doing what I'm doing, you become very much more self-observant, much more introspective.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Now, you said when you got the Horatio Alger Award, that was the first time that you were telling this story?
Publicly.
Wow.
The book didn't come out till 2020.
So, and you said that when you were 18, you said that was a pass and you hit it.
18, my father was a merchant marine. Mother died when I was 3. That was it. No conversation. Never told anybody about being in an orphanage. No, that was
until when?
I was ashamed. I didn't want any advantage from that. I was ashamed. I said I didn't want anybody to give me anything because I went through that, and that served me very well. I mean, that was a very strong decision. When I talked to the Horatio Alger kids, I said, "You got two decisions. You can let it all hang out, which is fine. You deal with that." And you can bury it as I buried it. Now, the psychologists will tell you it's not a good idea to bury it. But I think a little bit of whether you call it is not bad. I didn't have to spend my time talking about my background. I could spend my time being the kind of person I wanted to be.
Wow. It's amazing. All right. That went fast. Okay. 2 minutes. Tell us your vision for the world or the impact you want to make. If your course and all that and your books are successful, how would you like to leave the world? Not that you're going anywhere, but how would you like to have it, the world?
Well, the idea that it's a little bit of a cliche. You're not going to live forever. Make things that will live forever. And I have a couple of those. One is, of course, the University of Rochester's School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, which has my name on it, so kids have pronounced correctly. The second thing is the golf course in Nantucket, which will last for 100 years. And we made that. We turned it from a club into an institution, the largest charity on the island now. We have 100 kids in schools. The golf course has 100 kids in schools and has an $18 million foundation now. That all came out of the generosity of the members. But my real effort at this point in time is two. One is to add this dimension to college education. To really give kids a chance to think more about themselves. The world has more opportunities, but it's much more complex. And so that's my goal. And the second minor crusade I have is to orient more and more kids toward what they used to call vocational education. I call it professional education. Nurses, marine engineers, public safety workers, hospitality people, I have a program down here in Key Largo for carpenters, plumbers, electricians, and HVAC people. They're the happiest people in the world. They come to your house and they do something and you pay them good money and they walk away feeling very good. You walk away feeling pretty good too. So my goal is basically right now is this orientation toward If I can change people's lives, I'm convinced, given what happened to me, that 17 to 25 year old, helping them make decisions is what I really like to do. And it's what I want to leave behind. Everyone that I find that who ends up with that capability makes me feel very good.
Wow. Well, thank you, Ed. Thank you.
Thank you. No, without you, I wouldn't have been able to talk about this.
Thank you for being willing to tell your story and for being willing to be the example for all of us. You know, again, the island of the four P's, on the road less traveled. If you ever think you have a hard life, read these books and you will get your head out of your you-know-what. And you know what? Really, just such a great example for all of us. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started Getting Real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.